not sure this reflection really has a title, but it's based on a traditional Chinese story, which might be called The Old Men of the Frontier or The Old Man Who Lost His Horse or something like that. I don't know if it's got a formal title. And I actually first encountered it in my first year classical Chinese class. It was the first thing we read. I am amazed at it now when I look at it because it's got some pretty difficult stuff in it. And I guess we can call it, it's a traditional Taoist tale that I'd like to build on a little bit from a more Zen perspective. And I first thought it was a bit frivolous, and I'm now almost I'm very conscious of the how far it can extend and how limited my own understanding or the appreciation of the situations that can come up is. Anyway, I'm going to read a translation that appears in an Alan Watts, I think, text of some sort, which is a good retelling of it, I think, and much better than I could translate it, I'm sure. So once upon a time, there was a Chinese farmer whose horse ran away. That evening, all of his neighbors came around to commiserate. They said, "Oh, we're so sorry to hear your horse has run away. That's most unfortunate." And the farmer said, "Maybe." The next day, the horse came back, bringing 7 wild horses with it. And in the evening, everybody came back and said, "Oh, isn't that lucky? What a great turn of events. You now have 8 horses." And the farmer said, "Oh, maybe." The following day, his son tried to break in one of the horses and train it. And while riding it, he was thrown and broke his leg. The neighbor said, "Oh, dear, that's too bad." And the farmer responded, "Maybe." The next day, the conscription officers came round to conscript people into the army. And they rejected his son because he had a broken leg. And again, all the neighbors came around and said, "Isn't that great?" And of course, the farmer said, "Maybe." Right. Okay, I often think of that tale as I navigate just daily life. And it seems to me that it's happened so often that something happens that upsets me a little bit, and then immediately afterwards, you know, there's a turn of events, and I think of that story. So, I mean, we hear stories on quite a significant level about the missing your plane connection, only to have the plane crashed or hijacked or something like that. And it does happen, and people say, you know, gee, I'm so lucky I missed the connection. Or on a more mundane level, you wake up feeling good and realize you've overslept and you'll be late for a medical appointment, start hurrying, and then the receptionist rings apologetically to cancel the appointment because the doctor's ill, and you have an extra hour of free time to enjoy breakfast, and then you burn the toast, and, you know, on and on, so it goes. And I'm finding it particularly because of my own personal situation where there are lots of, it seems to me, ups and downs. And I use that term, and that's a contradictory to really the message I want to be reflecting on today, that monitoring my own or a family member's medical conditions. And that does seem, well, you think of a medical chart, don't you? And you think of a graph going up and down, that sort of thing. So now, as far as I can understand the Taoist meanings, of that. And in fact, it's prefaced, the story is actually prefaced in, I don't know if it's not the original in the way it's been handed down, with the sentence, "Good luck and bad luck create each other, and it's difficult to foresee their change." So it's a kind of yin-yang kind of thing. There's the seed of the one in the other. So in the yin-yang thing, there's always the seed of the opposite color, the white and the black. And it's a cautionary tale about making premature judgments. In a sense, the jury's always out. You know, you don't know what's going to happen next. And in fact, now if Alan Watts translates it or relies on a translation that says maybe, it's a little bit more explicit in the Chinese text that's handed down. And it's elaborated a little bit more. So the old man says, in fact, how do we know it can't unexpectedly become the opposite? It's a little bit more, I take it, in a sense, yeah, I sort of like the maybe, actually. It's a little bit too specific with, but that's a Taoist interpretation. So the seed of the opposite is always inherent in what's facing us. And there's an inevitability about change. I used to have a little sign up in my office, I think, that the only thing constant is change. Now, to try to move to a more Zen appreciation of what this might mean, and I must say, there are bits here which I'm really struggling with now. We read the text this morning about the identity of the absolute and the relative, and that's very, along with the Heart Sutra, is very relevant to trying to unpack this kind of, this story from a Zen point of view. So those texts tell us that the relative and the absolute both exist, okay, and they have their own uses. So we're not denying the relative, which is the everyday encounters that we have. So that's a very old, it's an 8th century Chinese and then Japanese text. And it's a very difficult one to understand. And there are whole books written, you know, trying to unpack that. It's not very long, but it isn't easy. And what I'm saying is a personal, you know, interpretation based, coming from the story in particular. There are many other ways that it could be looked at, I think. So, I mean, it's telling us that sounds may be pleasant or unpleasant. We can't deny that in our everyday life, that in the relative plane, that's true. Some things, yeah, I don't like much modern music, I must say. My classical tastes are pretty standard, and I really like harmony, and I don't like dissonance. So that's pleasing to my ear or not pleasing to my ear. And in one of my favorite phrases, it says, water is wet and fire is hot. Okay, that's the way it is. Now, of course, it can be seen as much more complicated. Water floods, fire burns, and we're very, very, you know, these days aware of what that may mean. So it's not to deny and go to a different plane, this absolute plane where, in a sense, we treat everything as without putting a judgment on it. And that may also be important, but we've got to recognize that the judgment is separate, or what I would say the discernment is separate from the phenomenon itself. Both are important, and that sometimes gets overlooked. So words, for instance, can be very helpful to clarify things, but we've got to avoid getting caught up in word games. It's very interesting that I've been reading a commentary by Suzuki Shunryo, the guy who wrote Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, on this text. Actually, I forgot I had it. It's a whole book just on that, on the text that we read this morning. And at the very end, there's a chance for students to ask questions. And somebody asks, it seems to me it's quite pointed, well, how come you do all this reading before you prepare a talk? So that, in a sense, Zen is the transmission that exists outside of words, and yet how many Zen words have been written, how many texts are there? So that's not to deny that the importance, and Suzuki says, well, my teacher said it's a good idea to look at the text before I start talking about that thing. So he's not in any way denying and saying or devaluing the written word. So the sutra that we did read, or the readings that talks about refined and common speech come together in the dark. Clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. So both things are needed. There is the transcendent, the absolute, the coming together, and that's symbolized by the darkness. But it's also important to clarify clear and murky in the light. So it's important not to privilege one over the dark, over the light, which some people have a tendency to do. It goes on to say, in the light there's darkness, but don't take or meet it as darkness. In the dark there is light, but don't see it as light. Now, these are very difficult passages, I think, and I looked at a whole lot of translations, the different ones. I think the one we have is even less clear than some others. In fact, one line had been left out, and we restored that, I think, last year. So in light there is darkness, don't meet it as darkness, literally perhaps. In the dark there is light, but don't see it as light. Light and dark oppose one another like the front and back foot in walking. So for those of us lucky enough to be able to walk on two legs, we need the front and the back to do that. And again, the translation, light and dark oppose one another. I would see it more as light and dark complement one another. You can't, you know, otherwise we'd be hopping instead of walking, I guess. And in the Heart Sutra, which we read every time, recite every time, really that's very much at the core of it. But no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, or mind. No form, sound, smell, touch, taste, or object of the mind. Now, the mind bit is very important here. Because, well, we can quote Hamlet, who says, there's nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. So we're adding, in a sense, adding value or devaluing by adding to the phenomenon, whatever it is. And this is pretty tough stuff. When I've just been sitting here before, and somehow I got quite consumed by visions of the Maribyrnong River and floods. I mean, this is, you know, you can't avoid that. Unpleasant is not a strong enough word for that to happen. So, you know, how to, at the extreme, so that's different from being late to work. But is it? Do the same principles apply about what the mind does, what it adds on top of the phenomenon? So from a Zen point of view, certainly there's a caution about making judgments while acknowledging the reality of the phenomenological, our everyday life. We can't deny, you look at a picture, I don't know, I picture my cycling group used to have lunch at the Angler's Tavern sometimes, which is now, or was, at least one story deep in water, you know, looking at television. That's a reality. You know, how we deal with that, or how the owners of the tavern deal with that, is a question for Zen too. So what on the absolute plane, how do we do? So I can offer a few reflections, but I feel it would be very arrogant to make pronunciation or Pollyannish, just to say, well, tomorrow the sun's going to shine, the water's going to go down. It's not like, you know, your horse leading seven horses back again. So the Zen message, in some ways, while acknowledging the dualism of the phenomenological world, transcends categories like good and bad. So the story of the lost horse illustrates the uselessness of judgments and dichotomies in general. But it's hard to abandon them. So on the one hand, I'm very conscious of, for various health problems, I tend to measure myself a lot, and it just goes up and down, as we were saying before. So in fact, there's nothing intrinsic in, this is hard to say, I'm not sure that this is true as I talk about it, intrinsic in the events themselves that make them good or bad. It'd be hard to say that about a flood, or a bushfire. Maybe in a very long run, you know, soil gets nourished or something like that. But boy, you know, I wouldn't want to talk to somebody who's just experiencing that and say, hey, you know. But still, in many situations, at least, the same events can be perceived as good as bad or bad, depending on your standpoint, depending who you are. So, well, in fact, we do know about bushfires. So under certain circumstances, they can be regenerative. Not on the scale, perhaps, that we've seen them in recent years. So at one point, acting the introduction to Suzuki's book on that sutra, that the student who wrote the introductions quotes Suzuki as saying that maybe the secret of Soto Zen is yes, but, as in that story. So that it's important to, while accepting the everyday reality of the situation that's confronting us, to avoid the judgmental part of it, the measuring part. Again, the Korean Zen teacher Sung San talks about the don't-know mind. That's one of my favorite phrases. I use it to don't know. You know, we can say that, and one of the attractive things about Zen is its sense of humor that we can say that. But these are really, really confronting things, I think, that we're facing as a, you know, as a society, both in Australia and around the world now. It's not a pleasant world, obviously. So I think there's a difference between making a judgment and discerning what is inherent. To me, discernment comes from within. Judgment comes from without. Judgment often comes from the ego. How does it affect me? Discernment, I think, arises from within and allows one to take wise action, skillful action. It doesn't mean we sit there because we're flooded and say, well, we'll wait for the sun to shine and everything will be all right. What is the practice, given the fact that we have what seems to be an unpleasant or catastrophic, really, event? So a phrase that I try to use and wish I could use more often when confronted with feeling, well, helpless or angry, or is, what is the practice right now? And it might be making the insurance claim. It might be driving safely, not rushing to catch the plane or the appointment. That's the practice. That's what's facing us. And to add catastrophe upon catastrophe won't help us act wisely. But still, without demeaning things, I think we, you know, I have to be careful about this. Suzuki, in that commentary, particularly on the part that I just read before, he talks about the basic tone of life remains the same, and in it there are some happy melodies and some sad melodies. It means that when it's hot or when you're sad, you should be completely involved in being hot or being sad without caring for happiness. And when you're happy, you should enjoy just being happy.